You're listening to Death of the Reader, Flex and Herds here for your Murder Mystery World Tour, and it's time for the finale of our coverage of The Bombay Prince by Sujata Massey. We are talking chapters 27 to 36 today here on the show, the latest iteration in the Pervin Mystery series as we're recording at the moment. Herds, you've made it. You've made it to the end of our Indian leg of this world tour.
I'm so happy to be here. I'd like to thank my family, my mother, my friends, my old university teacher, my lecturers. No, look, this has been such a wild ride through this book. Mm-hmm. I can't believe what a ramp up of events and expectations that we have in the final stretch of this novel. I was blown away by the finale that we decided to throw ourselves into and the amount of stabbing that goes on and strangling. It's crazy.
I think it's also it's not just that the ramp up is so intense. Mm. It's that it like goes into kind of cruise control for a couple of chapters before things start ramping up. And you're like, is this novel going to end?
Well, yeah, like, I mean, even in the final scene, we confront the murderer and their accomplice, you know, we get to all that. It doesn't feel like this is the final scene almost. Like,
yeah,
it feels like there's going to be a chase scene or some additional investigation to like prove they're the killer. Mm-hmm. But it's like, where do we go? And then the best character in the novel stabs a boy in the back, and that's all we need, you know? It's great.
It's really crazy.
It's very silly.
Yeah. We have these like few slice of life chapters leading up into that stretch, which are fascinating in their own right and enjoyable because of how like well fleshed out the characters in them are.
Yeah.
But it just kind of all comes to a head so quickly.
Yeah. I mean, it's prompted, you know, we're going to, I believe it's to deliver some paperwork to the family of the victim for any cutting master. And we just kind of coincidentally go to check in on Koresh, who is apparently dying of what seems to be poison.
Violently like ill.
It comes out of complete nowhere. Like, obviously, the foreshadowing.
He's in bed and he's like, I deserve this. And Pervin just says, we have got to get this boy to
a
hospital.
We have to save him.
And his mother says,
he'll be fine.
Oh, well, we'll take him to the cheap hospital a few hours away.
It's so interesting.
Pervin's like, no.
Like, it's not like it's not foreshadowed all the way through this novel. Every time we see Koresh, he's like, and bullied around by Naval. He's very like meek. He doesn't seem like he entirely knows what's going on. And so seeing him there, like on the edge of the bed, you know, he's thrown up, he's not eating. He's trying desperately to avoid doing anything with his life because he thinks it's over.
Yeah.
And Pervin just happens to come along and be his little guardian angel there. It's fantastic.
It's a really interesting sequence too, because I feel like in most murder mystery novels, this would have been the second, like the middle part. This would have been week
the
two
twist,
for us,
right?
Normally.
Yeah, exactly. Like, whoa, who's trying to poison Koresh? What does he know? Yeah, exactly.
It gets so slammed up against the back. And then even after we do that, we still kind of like diffuse for a little bit before action kicks back up again. Like, you know, Sujata Massey is clearly trying to like disarm you as the end approaches.
And then it's all kind of abrupt. You know, we go to check in on Koresh. We find out that someone has been seeing him, someone who claims he's his brother, I believe.
Yeah.
And they just want to take him
who
for
could
a
could it be?
Who could it be? And well, I mean, shall we get into it?
We should also mention that one of the scenes that we've had in the middle is that Dinesh Apti, who's been in prison this entire time, is being charged with Frenny's death, and Pervin's like debating whether or not she's going to defend him.
It's such a good scene too. Oh my goodness, we have to talk about this. That scene had completely slipped my mind. I feel terrible.
Yeah.
Because we had this whole interrogation of Dinesh, and the other thing, which again, this ties into the like coincidences that allow Pervin to kind of be at the exciting moment of the case or of the drama.
Yeah.
Like, Dinesh was supposed to be represented by a very prestigious lawyer, I suppose.
Yeah, Pervin's dad says he's like the best criminal lawyer in Bombay.
But as the case kind of turned fouler, the prestigious lawyer decided to hand it off to, I assume, his intern, this like other lawyer who doesn't know what he's talking about.
Some
schmuck. And so when this schmuck says, oh, I gotta go off for a coffee, Pervin, She's like, oh, I suppose that means I won't be able to see Dinesh today because normal policy is that you're not supposed to be able to see another lawyer without your lawyer being present because they can manipulate you. And he's no, you can just go right in. Just go have a chat with him. I don't see the harm in that. It almost feels like a conspiracy. I was waiting for someone to pop up at the end and say, aha, I was that schmuck all along.
There's a lot of stuff in this stretch that feels like conspiratorial.
It does.
There's that scene where she like runs into Colin outside the Asiatic Society.
Yeah.
And
oh, no.
Like it's this very innocuous scene where they're just kind of having a vaguely flirtatious conversation and being a little bit apologetic that they haven't been able to meet up.
And then
and it's written with the aura that like someone is watching them.
But that's what's so good about it. Oh my goodness. Because they end up in like the secret garden where it's like a public place, but no one's looking at them. Like no one's like around. They can kind of hear that people are nearby. It's like, are we going to get found out? And then they're looking deeply into each other's eyes and no one knows who started kissing first, but it happens. Lord, it happens. Best scene in the book. Oh my goodness. Oh, I wanted to get right into the mystery on this one, Flex, but you're just reminding me of all the best parts of this story.
I mean, and this is the thing is like, I think that the way that we're discussing this is adequately conveying how disjointed the end of it feels, but it's not like problematically disjointed.
It's
just that these puzzle pieces could go in any order, and Sujata Massey has like picked a really bizarre order at that.
Yeah, it's pretty great. Anyway, yeah, so all of this is to say that we pick up the pieces through Koresh's personality and he's, you know, the terrible things he's going through and Dinesh's testimony. And I mean, there's some kind of hard clues that we go through, like we figure out because the servant says, you know, I heard someone breathing in the library and it turns out to be Dinesh, I believe, or I believe it is Dinesh.
I think so.
And, you know, we talk about how there were two boys seen hopping over the fence from the nearby like hotel complex, that sort of thing. And all of it is to say that in the end, really, it was all about one psychopath who wanted to have his way and was willing to manipulate the people around him to get what he wanted. Because we do find out, as I've kind of alluded to, that Naval Hotawala is the killer.
Well done.
Effectively. Thank you.
Yeah, I think I'm going to be brief about this. I think you're going to walk away with 3 points from this
one. I'm happy with that. Because honestly, like, I definitely screwed up on Koresh. I don't know what you're thinking, but when I read, you know, the motivation for Naval, I was like, yeah, that pretty much lines up with what I said. But with Koresh, apparently the manipulation was you need money to go to school.
Yeah.
Whereas I was like, oh, it's clearly to do with that boy who died 8 years ago, however long ago it was.
Yeah. It's curious because it's not explicitly denied, which is why I was like kind of unsure about it when we were speaking between these episodes.
It's kind of a theme of this book though, isn't it?
Yeah.
So,
but it's not explicitly confirmed either, which means I can't really land you the points for it.
No, I'm happy with 3. I think that I was definitely stretching at that point. Do we want to talk about the spy in the room as well?
Oh my God, can we please?
The best character?
I did not see this coming at all, and I was in a fit of giggles when Sujata Massey confirmed the identity and purpose of J.P. Singer.
He's a government spy.
He's an American government spy who may have been there to assassinate the prince.
May have. Look, we don't know for sure, but we don't know that. He may have been there. It's not clear if he is, as I kind of mentioned last week, if he is or isn't the plainclothes detective who's mentioned in the early parts of the story.
Yes.
I like to think that he is.
I like to think he is as well. I hadn't thought of it, but when you said it, I was like, oh my God, that's so tidy.
Yeah, it works. I mean, look, Sujata, you can steal that one. That's for free. but clearly, yeah, he's there for ulterior motives. And whether it's to assassinate the prince or protect him, clearly that's what's on the agenda.
Yeah.
What I love about his character, about Jay's character, is that in the moment where we confront Naval and Naval is trying to kill Praveen, which is an insane scene, by the way.
So intense.
It's awful. I thought, are we actually going to kill this character? Surely not. The tension is suddenly relieved as Naval, and he pulls back and I think he falls into the fountain. I hope he did anyway. It's that whole cleansing symbolism thing. And he has a knife in his back, or a knife wound in his back.
Yeah.
And there's Jay standing there. And it's a very quick scene where Jay just says, yeah, I may not be, you know, the casual lackadaisical reporter you thought I was. Please let me get away. That'd be really nice of you, Pervin. And he runs up into the night. But there's a lot implied by the moment, because obviously he's a spy. He's supposed to like think about things strategically. And so he, in this moment, is thinking, what is the most ethical, efficient way that I can solve this problem? Because I can't get caught here. You know, I can't, you know, restrain Naval. I can't restrain the murderer, because then I get caught in that chase, or in like having to answer questions. Why are you holding this young man? Right.
I understand your point here that he kind of had to go for the kill because it's the least risky situation. But at the same time,
it was the most efficient.
He still
solution.
Kind of doesn't get away with it.
Not quite.
And you know, he's still fallen on his sword for Pervin, who he's kind of been a B-side love interest for.
It's great. He puts himself at immense risk. It's fantastic.
Yeah. I really like that when we're wrapping up the crime, that it's kind of treated that the murder of Frenny has almost been like de facto pinned on JP because Naval isn't around to confirm it anymore.
Well, it ties into what I was saying last week about how we're constantly subverting these regular murder mystery tropes. And the easiest one is the suspect lineup. And the, you know, now we're going to try them. We're going to lay out all the evidence against Naval, but we don't get any of that because we got a spy who needs to get the heck out of there. He doesn't have time for any of that nonsense. We had to cut to the chase. You know, I love that so much. It's such a fun solution.
Though I suppose on the more mystery side, though, like I don't feel like there's much of a way to see the JP Singer twist coming, which I don't have a problem with because it's such a great reveal and twist at the end. But part of me as a mystery fan was also kind of craving that there'd be a few more clues his way.
I feel like the mystery is like, it's interesting in this novel, but I don't feel like the mystery is what kept me hooked.
Definitely.
You know, like there's not a puzzle. It's just about following these characters' journeys and following Pervin's, you know, following her attempts to solve the murder and how she gets these crazy situations.
Yeah, I think there's definitely, like, if you go back through the novel and to Sujata Massey's credit here, you can still see the foreshadowing and all of the things that make way more sense in hindsight that way.
Sure.
Which is, you know, I guess the thing I crave more than the puzzle, so I'm still totally happy with it.
Mm-hmm.
But I would be very, very surprised if anyone managed to get ahead of that particular reveal, because there's almost, like, no reason for it to happen in the story. It's so unmotivated, but nonetheless the less compelling.
Yeah, like I figured that Jay was, you know, there was more to Jay than met the eye, but I would not have picked him as a spy working for the American government. I would not have gone in that direction, but I'm glad that someone did, you know.
It's almost weird because, as you were saying, like, there's so much subversion of the tropes here, but the, like, one foreign guy being a spy for the government
just thinking
is
that.
Like the one we commit to, and it's amazing.
It's the Knox rule, right? There must be no American in the story, right?
Exactly.
But as always, there's the way you can subvert that trope and have it be a good fun time, and, you know, not feel unfair, which I think has been very well done.
Anyhow, I think we should wrap this part of the discussion here. We've got a little bit of a twist coming up for the end of our Indian leg in the back of the show. So stick around for that. This is your Murder Mystery World Tour here on 2SER 107.3. You're listening to Death of the Reader. We've been in India for a little while here on your Murder Mystery World Tour, and we've come to the end of that leg of said tour with Sujata Massey's The Bombay Prince. We've been discussing all the way to the end of that novel today. And Herds, I wanted to dial back a little bit, not all the way on the spoilers for The Bombay Prince, but I also wanted to dial up a little bit, not all the way, on the spoilers from the other Indian novels that we've covered, because if you've been reading along with this the whole time, it should be very apparent to you why I chose to wrap the leg up with this particular book.
I mean, we were talking about how this novel ends with a talk being given, and on instinct I said, ah, yes, Praveen, she decides to give the talk at the end of this novel.
And I'm like, what?
And then I realize, wait a second, no, that's not this novel. That's Dying Day. This is the one where she decides to attend someone else's talk.
Yes.
It's pretty good. Pretty good parallel.
A staggering number of parallels in the Bombay Prince. I mean, we referenced the same real life crime that happened as the one Nev March mentioned in Murder in Old Bombay. We have the same weird espionage journey that we did in The Shadows of Men.
Mm-hmm.
We deal with the same character journey that we did in The Dying Day. It's just, it's such a nice foot to land on at the end of this leg.
It's an excellent cap on the journey so far. And that's not to say that we won't come back to Indian novels in the future.
Oh, yeah. And just for the record, people keep messaging me being like, when are you going back to Japan? Eventually, okay?
At some point. Look, we can only do it so many times a year, okay? Or every 2 years, as the case may be. But, you know, it's always good to do a stint through a country and kind of explore, you know, all these different authors that work in the same space and influence each other, right? It's like, the fun.
And so much of it covers the same history, right?
You know,
think about the stuff that you would have learned about wherever you grew up in school. There's a lot of similar themes, ideas, and events. And I don't want to call it an oversimplification of India,
It's a certain perspective, right?
Yeah.
We're seeing, it's not the same perspective. We're seeing several authors' perspective on the same cultural journey that they grew up with, right?
And I really like that as a slice of India to look at through crime fiction, because it not only shows you like the great diversity that there is in all of the different facets of India that these authors were able to write about within a very similar structural framework.
Sure.
But it also goes to show how, you know, India is kind of seen by the outside world, where despite being in ostensibly a post-colonial era, we still view it through a very colonial lens.
Yeah, I mean, we've talked about this on the show before, how so many, like, the records of the history of India have been, I mean, not entirely wiped clean, but, you know, colonialism definitely did a number on it. So I think that any author's attempt to kind of analyze that period of history and even to, you know, recapture something from before is, you know, really admirable.
I also found it fascinating. I kind of want to get your opinion on this, Herds, that so much of what we've seen has been about the, like, flash points when India pushed back, if that makes sense. The idea that, you know, maybe these authors are kind of like
rebellious,
optimistic about the abilities that people have to resist the power structures that they live within.
I like that you switched out the term rebellious for resistant. That's a clever...
Well, yeah. No, this is in reference to a panel from Sydney's Bad Crime Writers Festival that I've brought up a couple of times on the show. And I thought, I mean, let's hear from Solari at that panel, which you can now catch up online at their YouTube page, talking about what this literature of resistance idea is.
At its heart, crime fiction is about someone standing up and saying no. It's about someone resisting an injustice and doing something about it. A lot of people would look for the crime in crime fiction as a marker of our genre. But it's not so much that. The crime, yes, necessarily has to occur, but it is the resistance to the crime, the resistance to an injustice that follows, that is really the heart of a crime fiction novel.
See, I might have been to that one. It's been so long. I feel like it's been a lifetime. But I mean, I remember the idea of resistance. I remember learning about that back when I was in university.
Yeah.
There was a subject that I took, which is about graffiti as a mode of resistance, and how, you know, people put ads on billboards and then someone graffitis over it. And the graffiti is like the problematic element there. It's not the ads being displayed in the local neighborhood that never asked for the ad to be put there. You know, which one is the eyesore? Obviously, that's a debate that I can't settle on my own.
Well, and it's also a debate that, you know, is going to vary a lot by context.
Absolutely.
Without naming names, there's a particular chain of billboards that have been celebratedly defaced in Australia at the moment.
Well, exactly.
Which is like, you know, in many ways the same act, but it's viewed publicly so differently.
Yeah, for sure. And I think that not to say that Indian authors that we've covered on the show are the graffiti authors of our show. I don't know where I'm going with this, but but I do think that you're onto something there with the idea that authors who choose to write about times of unrest, but not just times of unrest, but ones which lead to positive change. Mm. Even though I think most of the stories we've covered look at that change with a critical lens.
Yeah.
Not to go too in depth into old Bombay, but the kind of cultural exchange that occurred, you know, that has occurred between the British and India. You know, it is two-sided.
Yeah, and that's like one of the really compelling things about Murder in Old Bombay. I mean, Nev March said it here herself.
This is about a particular small community of Parsis. And what that means is it's a very small community, less than 100,000 people in the whole world, had an enormous effect on the history of India. This is a little bit of a crusade for me to try to modernize my community. And the way I chose to do it was from the point of view of an outsider who loves them.
I mean, the same with like Abhir Mukherjee as well, where he's talking about how we learn the same history, but Indian history is in many ways, in his own words, sometimes more valid.
Sure.
What always struck me was, why are we not looking at our own history? Why are we not looking at the corruption in ourselves? And the answer is we don't really want to. We don't like shining a mirror on our own past. We learn about these instances from 500 years ago in British history, but we don't see the history of 50 years ago or 60 years ago, the things that actually changed things or things that matter. We keep quiet or we brush under the carpet.
All of these clips I'm playing, aside from the one from Bad Sydney Crime Writers Festival, by the way, are up on the podcast in their various episodes with these authors. So go have a look there. Nev March and Abhir Mukherjee, we've just heard from. And yeah, the bits that haven't been erased by colonialism kind of have to serve as a bit of a lesson.
I mean, there's the age-old adage that if you're in a situation where you have, when you have one truth that is being trumpeted by a power, the British colonial power, and then you have a less powerful, you know, a minority group speaking their own truth, it is worth listening to the minority and understanding their perspective.
I think one of the great things about the Bombay Prince as a concluding piece for that is the way that so much of it is about speech. Despite being a crime novel, most of the scenes that we have aren't sitting down with the suspects and grilling them on what happened, not having chase scenes and dramatic confrontational encounters. Most of it's like attending regular social day job life and still working towards this sense of justice and social progress.
I honestly, I could read the book without the murder mystery, I think, and still have a really great time.
Well, I mean, that's been so true for so many of these novels, right? Like,
sure.
You know, Murder in Old Bombay.
It's real.
If you were to, if you were to take out the murder mystery parts,
you'd have a love story.
Adventure novel buried in there with a love story built in is fantastic. If you were to just give me like history tour that Vasim Khan was reaching for in The Dying Day, you'd have a fantastic story. And if you were to supplant the just absolute chaos of The Shadows of Men, you'd be fine anywhere. Like, the only novel we covered in our Indian leg that's inseparable is Avi Raman's.
And that's deliberate as well. Like, he deliberately set out to write a Golden Age-style detective novel. And there are plenty of other books that he's written. I talked about Fraudster kind of during that stretch, in which, again, you could probably take out the murder and still have a pretty good time.
Obviously, this is a fact that's true for like most good crime fiction these days. I was speaking with Aoife Clifford a while ago, ahead of the Sydney Writers Festival, about her novel When We Fall and how she felt that there wasn't any reason to not have a good murder mystery and a good story at the same time.
The beauty of crime fiction, the hand it sort of puts out to the reader and says, not only do I want you to enjoy this read, I want you to actively read it by trying to solve it along with me. And the joy of trying to solve it before the main character does, awesome. I'm a greedy reader. I want the books I read to have great characters, great sentences, And also you can still have the puzzle, and that puzzle shouldn't be kind of diminished.
That chat with Aoife Clifford ahead of the Sydney Writers Festival is going up on the podcast pretty soon, so make sure you're subscribed up there if you aren't already. And yeah, as she says in that interview, that's kind of a standard that existed because that's just what writers had achieved so far, but we're kind of past that.
Yeah, well, I mean, not to go too far back or get too philosophic here, but obviously the traditional crime fiction stories are games, right?
Yes.
They're there to have fun. They're there to, like, that's what the Detection Club was all about. You sit around, you have your tea, and you talk about, oh, what chapter will I write next? Maybe you'll guess who the murderer was, but where was the butler? And that's sometimes how we treat this show as well, you know, with the point system and, like, everybody's, we're solving the murder, you know, we're switching back and forth. But crime fiction as a genre, in the way that it has been melded with other genres and other styles of fiction, obviously is much more than a game now. It is a way to often highlight the mysteries of the world, the hidden truths of cultures that we're not always privy to.
Yeah.
And I think now that I've said that, finally just stated that thought, that's kind of how I feel India has left its impression on me.
Yeah.
Detective fiction in this culture is being used to highlight the hidden truths of British colonialism and the way that it has impacted the culture.
I want to expand on that and rebut a little bit.
Sure.
Because on the one hand, I think you're absolutely right. That's totally what Indian crime fiction has left its impression on me. But I don't want to make the suggestion in that crime fiction is somehow the only type of fiction or the only type of writing that can do that. But the thing that crime fiction does well for me is it makes a very palatable entry point for that, right?
That's fine.
You know, as we were talking about during The Dying Day, how a lot of historical fiction readers love treating the genre as a sounding board to then go and learn more history. There's more of a constant sense of turmoil that Indian crime fiction tackles.
It's a good one.
You know, even in that modern snapshot in A Dire Isle, that there is so much more to India, all of these other territories we haven't seen, these other cultures in the country that we haven't touched. Like, had you heard of Bundelkhand before we covered A Dire Isle? I'd be surprised if so.
Yeah.
And, you know, through that, there are so many different entry points to understanding India.
Sure.
And no matter where you step first, it would only be the beginning.
I think it's interesting watching you skirt around the supernatural elements of A Dire Isle, but I agree with what you're going for there.
Yeah, I mean, the supernatural stuff is something that hasn't really come up a lot in covering the Indian fiction that we have. And when we were talking with Avi Rahman, you know, maybe there's still a bit of work internally that has to happen.
See, India in many ways, you know, it's an extremely old civilization, thousands of years old. And we have myths and stories which go back donkey's years. One of the things that's been happening in the Indian fiction market over the last 10 years is a lot of these old epics and classics are being reinterpreted. They are being rewritten for the young audience. Many of these epics are written from a male's viewpoint. So you have writers now who are writing it from a female character's viewpoint.
And so it seems like it's only a matter of time, right? You know, mythological archetypes are fun, right, Herds?
I love the Myth of Icarus. It's my favorite one.
I have no idea which book we're poking fun at here.
Any book that has Greek mythology in it. Exactly. Yeah. It's yeah.
So I hope here at the end of our current Indian leg of our Murder Mystery World Tour that you've found your foothold to get into the world of Indian fiction and enjoy some of the absolute treats that are there.
Awesome.
But at the very least, Herds, it's time for us to depart and
I know.
Get back.
We're having a bit of a shake-up too. Like, I don't even know what book we're doing. I mean, I do, but
you do know what book we're doing. And the reason we both know is because neither of us is the expert.
It's true. We're going in blind into John Dixon Carr's The Crooked Hinge.
Yes, we have Brad Freeman back from the R Suite Mystery Blog.
Back from the dead.
He joined us last year for Halloween Party for our Halloween special.
Mm.
And we're having him back on to finally get him the chance to challenge us to his favorite puzzle in murder mystery.
It's so exciting. Finally, I can listen to somebody else rant about their favorite murder mystery and tell me all these high concept theses, It's going to be great. I'm looking forward to it.
Next week on the show, we are covering Death of a Man, which is chapters 1-6 of The Crooked Hinge by John Dixon Carr. I am frightened and excited.
I'm horrified.
Herds, thank you for joining me on this Indian tour.
It's been great being here. I'm looking forward to a change. And who knows what the future may hold? Crooked Hinge, let's go.
Let's go. This is Death of the Reader, your murder mystery world tour here on 2SER 107.3. We'll see you with Crooked Hinge next week. We're out of here.